This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast. This week, neuroscientist Lisa Genova discusses how our memory works in her book, Remember, The Science of Memory and the Art of Forgetting.
Lisa, it's great to see you. This is going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
But I have to start out by saying, not cool. You're a fiction writer. Why are you invading our space with nonfiction? You're already the queen of fiction. It's like you've got this gigantic kingdom, and it's not enough for you. You need to come over to the nonfiction writer's world and just demolish us as well. What's going on here?
Please, says the man who writes nonfiction, has a podcast, and now is a famous musician.
But I did want to start out by asking you. You've written five novels, right, before this book.
Yep.
And to say you've carved out a niche is a great understatement, and we'll get to that in a second. But why nonfiction? I mean, what finally tempted you over to nonfiction? And I'm also wondering, do you see this as very much a blip in your long fiction writing career, or do you see yourself now more fluidly kind of going back and forth?
So the reason for writing this, the intention behind this was, I've been talking about Alzheimer's around the world for over a decade now, and that's super important work to me personally. I know it is to you as well. I'm really trying to help folks understand this disease, be less afraid of it, encourage earlier diagnosis and resources for care and research. It turns out, though, that every time I spoke about Alzheimer's, the conversation eventually shifted to memory and forgetting in general. And I found that folks over the age of 40, definitely over the age of 50, are all really kind of freaked out, stressed out, worried, ashamed of everyday moments of normal forgetting, but they don't know it's normal. So they think that, especially after a certain age, every time I walk into a room and can't remember why I went in there, or I can't come up with the name of the actor in that movie I saw last week, I can't remember the name of the movie. I went to the store to buy milk and I came home with a bunch of groceries and no milk. People start to worry that this is a sign of impending dementia, especially if they have a loved one with Alzheimer's. And so the intention became, we have enough to stress about in this world. If I can take this off of people's plates, like, you don't have to stress about these things. This is a normal outcome of how our human brains are designed. And it's very distinct from forgetting due to Alzheimer's. So I just wanted to help folks understand sort of the owner's manual. Like, this is how your brain works to remember things. This is why it normally forgets. These are the things you can do to protect it and improve it. And here's what you have to really worry about with respect to Alzheimer's. But most of what everybody forgets every day, whether you're 25 or 65, is totally normal.
Okay, so let me just do one follow-up on my question before we get into the actual book content. Mm-hmm. And that is, you've written five books, which are pretty, in a lot of detail, explored what these various neurological diseases are about, including Still Alice with Alzheimer's. So why did you have to switch over to what was necessary about coming over to nonfiction, since you do fiction, you're such an artist at it?
Thank you. And I am going to go back to that. And I'll never say that I'll never go back to nonfiction. I'll say I enjoy writing fiction a lot more. There's just so much more room to play and run.
Right.
So my next book will be a novel about a woman with bipolar disorder. And I'll probably write about addiction after that. But I reserve the right to dip into nonfiction again, because I think that this served, the nonfiction platform served a really great vehicle in this case, because I wanted this to feel like a friendly accessible conversation with a friend who just happens to be a neuroscientist and can explain this to you. So I've been doing this in person, sort of one at a time. Like, people will come to me sort of confessing, you know, they're almost looking to get diagnosed in this very conversation. They're saying, like, Lisa, this is the things that have been happening to me. I can't remember names, and I have to write everything down. That if I need to do something later, if I don't write it down, I'm going to forget. And there, you can see the fear rising, as if they expect me to let them know that, yeah, you've got Alzheimer's, but they don't. And I explain to them what's going on, and I can see the relief. Yeah. And so I just, this book was, it was very clear that there's a need out there to understand our everyday lives, the everyday moments of forgetting, why that happens, and what to be concerned about and what not to be. And also to help, like, oh, if you've walked into a room and can't remember why you're in there, I can actually help you figure out why you're in there. Right. And at the same time, not panic about it. So it really was just a mission to sort of, you know, help everyone who's worried about memory worry about the right kinds of things and let go of the rest.
Right. Well, I mean, this resonates with me on several different levels, as you can probably understand. First of all, just as a person, I don't think there's any person over 40, and I'm 54, so I've been living, you know, with this anxiety for a bunch of years now of just having that not just one panic moment, but just a never ending series of deep concern moments where is what I'm forgetting normal forgetting? Is it just getting older? Is it just me being paranoid about getting older? Or is there something, you know, that I should be worried about here? And even though I'm now kind of trained in being able to understand the difference, even I still like experience that feeling. And then the second thing I resonate with just strongly is this, as you say in the book and as you've said here, literally you go and you do all these book talks, in my case about Alzheimer's disease, in your case about Alzheimer's and all these other diseases, and what do people want to talk about as soon as you've stopped talking is they want to talk about their own this fear that they have personally. They want to be reassured, they want to be told, oh, you should go see a doctor. They want to, like, you're their conduit to, like, you know, to the medical community in a way. So, like, just trying to put those answers down in a book form, and I found this book just so personally reassuring and answering a lot of the questions that I had and that I had started to answer in my mind for my research, but hadn't really, you know, put down. So thank you for that, first of all.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah, I think until it's articulated, like, you may have a sense of, like, man, I can't find my phone, or I'm misplacing, like, I can't remember where I put my phone, and I can't remember where I put my glasses again. And, like, man, what's going on with me? And I think the misconception is to jump to, oh, there's something going on with my memory. Like, my memory's failing, it's getting older, it's impaired, what's happening? But your memory probably was never even involved in any of these instances, because you can't create a memory if you don't pay attention to the information in the first place. So very likely we live such distracted lives. So we're probably thinking of the very next thing you need to do, and you're not paying attention to where you put your glasses down. And then later, when you can't find them, this isn't a failure of memory. This is a symptom of distraction.
Right.
Really understanding that, like, oh, when I can't find my phone, it was probably because I didn't pay attention to where I put it, rather than jumping to, oh my God, my memory's failing. So I think just really, like you said, like, laying it down on paper and seeing it explained can really help.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about what I think is the very biggest idea in the book, or at least the idea. Everything is narcissistic, so this is how I see the world. But and I'm so glad you spent a bunch of time on this, which is this kind of before we get to the ins and outs of actually how memory works and different kinds of memory and things like that. The big idea for me that we are not designed to remember every detail. In fact, if we were designed to remember every single detail, we would not have the kinds of powers of intelligence and kind of broad thinking that we do have. So we are designed to forget most the vast majority of the details that we come across. And in fact, there are examples of people who are encumbered by remembering too much detail. So if you could just kind of talk about, like, in a big way, kind of how our brains are designed to not remember most things. And then we can kind of get to, you know, what we are designed to remember and what's working and what isn't working.
Yeah. So again, it's really helpful to actually take some time to think about what we really do remember and what we don't, because people will talk about, like, I don't remember as much from 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And they sort of worry about, like, wow, I'm forgetting a lot of details from the past. And I would argue that you actually don't remember your most recent past. So, you know, today is Monday. A week ago Monday, can you tell me all the text messages that you sent and received? What'd you have for lunch? Tell me about your morning shower a week ago. Like, we don't remember. So our brains are designed to remember what is meaningful and what is emotional. Kind of full stop. Mm-hmm. Surprising goes in there because surprising elicits emotion. But what's meaningful to us, what matters, we remember. And we forget what isn't. So most of our lives are spent doing things that are kind of routine, habitual, day to day, same old, same old. Our brains don't remember same old, same old. So we spend much of our days doing the same thing. So we get up, we get dressed, we brush our teeth, we have coffee, we sit on a million Zoom calls, where now our days are even shrunk even more, right? We don't go as many places. So if you're feeling fuzzy from the past year, if you're feeling a little foggy about, like, I don't know, this year's a big blur, it's because we didn't get out and do as many things. You know, it wasn't different. It was the same day to day. And our brains forget what's routine. So that's kind of most of our days. So if you want to remember more of what happens in your life, you got to get out of your routine. You got to put new things in it. So things that are new and meaningful and emotional, things that matter to you, that stand out, that's what we remember.
Right. All those vacation days in cities that you never go back to, that you can remember very specific things because the context of that day was like no other context in your life.
Right. And we tend to talk about the things that were new and meaningful and exciting to us, right? So we have the chance to revisit that memory, and repetition of a memory helps us remember it. It reinforces the strength of those neural connections. So when I did something really cool and exciting, I'm going to tell my friends and family about it again and again. And that reminiscing helps reinforce the memory too.
All right, so let's dive into neuroscience for a second. You are literally a neuroscientist. You have a PhD in neuroscience, and you're basically Superwoman or Wonder Woman or whatever. I mean, you've got it all. So my question is very specifically that you just said that most of the memories we remember are either meaningful or emotional, and that's what we're designed to remember most of. Is the reason that we remember those because of that emotional moment, you know, the Challenger blowing up or whatever, and we're right there and it's seared in our memory? Or is the reason that that's the memory and that's the event that we keep going over and over and over in our heads and in conversations and things like that? Or is it both? And kind of how does that work in the biology of our brains?
It's a bit of both. And so now, actually, we're talking about a specific kind of memory, which is a memory for something that happened. And that's different biologically from the memory of stuff you know. So the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second, or, you know, my birthday, stuff you know. The memories for how to do things, so how to type, how to ride a bike, how to drive a car, that's different. Memories for stuff that you plan to do later. So right now we're talking about the stuff that happened, which is called episodic memory. And episodic memories for the stuff that happened are really influenced and enhanced by emotion. So if something happens and it's emotionally neutral, I might remember it. But if it's scary, if it's exciting, if it's joyful, if it's tragic, if there's an emotion built in that at the same time, that will contribute to that emotion being very strong and long lasting. So biologically, that's because there's a part of our brain called the amygdala. It's part of the limbic system, and that has a lot of direct connection and a lot of influence over the hippocampus, which is also in our limbic system. But the hippocampus is a structure that is required for the formation of any new consciously held memories. And so because of their relationship, we have like a very tight bond between emotion felt in the amygdala and hippocampus, which is busy connecting the different aspects and elements that contain a remembered moment or a remembered experience. So on the one hand, emotion strongly influences whether we're going to remember something or not. On the other, if it's emotional, we're also going to talk about it, right? Because that's the stuff that matters. That's the stuff that gets our attention. Again, it's sort of like, you know, it's a positive feedback loop here. What do we pay attention to? Whoa, that was a big emotion attached to that. That gets your attention. You can't remember something if you don't pay attention to it. Right. So if I'm driving from Boston to Cape Cod, I cross the Sagamore Bridge. I've done this thousands of times. I might be 10 miles past the bridge and suddenly think, did I already go over the bridge? I can't remember driving over a colossal four-lane bridge because I never paid attention to it. But if something, you know, if someone were standing on that bridge about to jump off, if there had been a car accident on the bridge, if someone called and there was like amazing news, someone's getting married and I happen to be on the bridge, I will remember driving over the bridge that day.
Right.
So emotion really helps us pay attention, which also helps us form memories.
Right. And I'm this is the part of the interview where I'm not sure where to go because there's so many different things I want to ask you about memory. But the top of mind right now is, I think you talk about in the book how you remember things that actually didn't happen. Can we talk about how that happens? Because that's another huge misunderstanding about memory, is that people have vivid memories from long ago, and some of the stuff they remember has been stuff that's been kind of wound into the story that didn't actually happen the way they remember it.
No, it might not have actually happened at all, or it might have happened, but you didn't experience it. You're borrowing from other people. So let's back up. So memories for the stuff that happened, again, unlike stuff you know how to do, stuff you plan to do later, are very vulnerable to editing and change. So the stuff that happened that you remember is probably wildly inaccurate. And people have done all kinds of studies of eyewitness testimony, people who were interviewed just after the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up or just after 9/11, and about where you were, who you were with, what do you remember, and then interviewed again a year later, 2 years later.
Right.
And their memories are totally different 2 years later versus right after. And then actually, these are tend to be college students too. There's a great study out of Emory of college students. So these are young people, not people who have, you know, aging brains who might be, you know, memory impaired. These are 20-year-olds interviewed immediately after the Space Shuttle Challenger. Who were you with? What were you doing? What'd you see? How'd you feel? Interviewed again 2 years later. Their answers don't match, like almost at all. And then shown their original handwriting, they look at that and think, well, that's strange. Like, that can't be right. They actually will stick to their newer false memories.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's humbling. And then eyewitness testimony is wrong much of the time, which is kind of frightening given how much we rely on that to convict folks. If I were to show you a video, this was done by Elizabeth Loftus, a video of a car accident, and then I ask you afterwards, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other? You'd give me an answer, say 30 miles an hour. If I instead said, how fast were the cars going when they crashed or when they smashed into each other, you would probably say they were going faster. So here's the deal. What happens after we remember something influences how we later restore it. So we can only capture what we pay attention to in the first place, right? So if I witness something, if I experience something, and my brain's not a video camera. My memory's not recording a constant stream of every sight and sound I'm exposed to. I'm only going to capture a certain part or slice of what actually happens. So to begin with, my memory is biased and distorted from what what someone else sees, right? So, a 54-year-old man witnessing something might notice different elements than a 22-year-old woman. Hmm. Your memories of the same event are gonna differ to begin with. Now, here's the weird part of our brain. So every time we recall a memory for what happens, we have the ability to add, subtract, change it, bring in new information. So if it's after 9/11, I then watch news reports and I might incorporate some of that information into what happened immediately after. If I'm on the phone with someone, maybe what she says and what she notices influences what I remember. I might leave some information out. I might, to make the story sound better, I might add some pieces of information to connect the dots. But here's what happens. Whatever has happened in the retelling or the reminiscing then gets stored over. It rewrites. It's like saving in Microsoft Word. It saves over the original memory. Right. The original memory is gone. And so now it's like the telephone game. The more I retell this memory, the further and further it has the opportunity to migrate away from what originally was my first memory of that event. So years later, I'm likely to be really, really far, far off from what I originally experienced. So if you have siblings, this is like a really cool exercise. If you have brothers and sisters, remember a holiday from your childhood or remember an event that all of you witnessed. So I could, my brother Tommy, remember Christmas when I was 10 and you were 8. And I might say, I might have a memory of what we got. Oh, we got skis and we did this. And he might have a completely different memory of that exact right. same day. And so we don't know who's what I try to help folks understand is you actually don't know. You can't know who's right and who's wrong in these instances. And you likely both have misinformation in your own memory.
All right, so now there are two follow-ups to that, yeah. And I don't know which one to start with, but I'll go with the first one that I thought of. Why? I mean, our brains are the most fantastic machines ever invented, and it's probably going to take a while for that to change, even with all the incredible machines we invent these days. Why would evolution design a brain that could change the way we actually remember something that happened that would make us unable to know whether that memory is a true memory or something that was then subsequently kind of edited in? That I don't, I mean, I can understand how we want to form a big intelligent picture and we want to keep improving on that intelligent picture. So you get a new piece of information, you make it more accurate, I guess, but to not be able to know in your own head whether this is a true memory or something that you changed along the way, and or to make it worse, as you said, to insist that it's a true memory, and even when you're looking at evidence that it's not. What's up with the design of our brains that makes that possible? Yeah.
So the first obvious answer for me is just that our memory system isn't perfect. It's so fallible. I mean, this is not the only instance where our brains are not designed well for remembering everything. So there's a strange paradox with memory, right? So on the one hand, if I decided I wanted to memorize 100,000 digits of pi, my brain's capable of that. Like, I can do that. You can do that. Anyone can. A Japanese engineer at the age of 69 memorized over 100,000 digits of pi because he wanted to. So we can do that. We can learn new languages. You can play guitar and write songs. Like, we can learn and memorize and remember anything. And it's gonna forget, to take your vitamin later or to return the library book. Like, it's this strangely, most astounding piece of equipment ever imagined, and it's a total dunce. It's going to make like bizarrely simple mistakes. And so I don't have an exact answer for you, but I can also imagine just sort of, evolutionarily wise, like our memories for what happened are somewhat collaborative. It's not dependent on just you. So like I said, I can only remember what I paid attention to. And so I'm going to miss a large portion of what actually happened just from the beginning. Like, I'm going to only have noticed, you know, people talk about eyewitness testimonies if there's a bank robbery. You know, if I'm the only person who witnessed what happened, I might have only seen the gun, but not the gunman's face, because I was so, you know, focused on the thing that could kill me. Mm. And I missed his face altogether. But someone else who was maybe not in the line of fire could have seen his face. So maybe this ability to collaborate on memory helps us get a fuller picture for what happened. And as a byproduct, we eventually can't tell, you know, what was originally my experience versus someone else's versus stuff we just made up, because we've got great imaginations and we're great storytellers. Our brain loves story. Anything that we can wrap a story around and a story that makes sense, our brains remember that.
Right. So the viewer will note that I almost stumped you. Even I tried and I couldn't, but I came closer than some maybe. All right. So my next follow-up to that, to this little micro subject, is there any way for us to know, as we're remembering something that's important, if we really care to know, like let's say we are on the witness stand or whatever, is there any way for us to know or to have hints about whether something is a true, accurate memory or it's something that we've edited along the way? Or do we just need to give up and just acknowledge that whatever we're remembering is simply the story we have taught ourselves to tell?
Yeah, I honestly think it's the best we can do. I think there needs to be an acknowledgement. And again, there's, you know, Elizabeth Loftus is a psychologist, and there are others out there who are sort of pounding the pavement with this message that our episodic memories are so fallible. They can contribute to a case and creating a picture, because obviously we don't need to throw it out entirely. If we witness something, if we experience something, there is certainly element of truth in there. There's certainly, hopefully, there's some, it doesn't distort so wildly that it's just completely off. But it's subject to all kinds of errors. And so to just hold someone's testimony as this is truth is dangerous. So I think it's a piece of the puzzle. And I think that, you know, for example, if you keep a diary and you write down what happens on your days, you're more likely to remember both what you wrote down and other elements, because what you wrote down can be a cue and a trigger for other pieces of what happened that day. So it helps unleash the rest of the memory if you keep a diary. So those can be more accurate. But on the flip side, they can also be less accurate, because if I write something down, it can also limit what I remember to only what I wrote down. And I've emphasized that so much that I might miss some other things that had happened, but I've now erased that from the memories. It's so far gone because I've now restored and revisited only this aspect of what happened, that the other pieces have gone away, and you can't convince me that they actually occurred. Mm. Tricky. Eyewitness testimony, I think, is incredibly flawed, and I don't think anyone should ever be convicted based on eyewitness testimony alone.
Yeah.
Neurobiologically, that's an injustice.
And I think the law enforcement community does, by and large, understand that now, right? We've gone kind of through a revolution in the last 20 years where at least most professionals, please correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like this is a story I have been, I'm in the memory field, so I know about this, but I would imagine that most, at least responsible judges and attorneys, know this fact.
Yeah, but you have to back it up from there, because I don't know, and I would doubt that most police officers are trained in the influence of their language on what someone's going to remember.
Right.
So like the example I gave of, if I show you a simple video and I change one verb in my question to you after you watch the video, how fast were the cars going when they contacted each other or smashed into each other? I'm going to change your memory for what you saw based on that verb. So if I'm a police officer and I'm questioning a witness, I'm interrogating someone, or if I'm talking to someone after, what did you see? My language can very much influence what the person will say they saw, and then therefore what they consolidate into memory of, this is what I saw, this is what I believe I saw. So the language of what we use to describe what happened will influence our future recollection of what happened.
So when the interview, this interview ends, we can do a, we can both rush, we'll really politely say goodbye, and then we'll both rush to call our agents to see who can be the first to get a book proposal going on eyewitness testimony.
You can do that. I'm writing about
my agent's on speed dial, so I hope yours is too. So all right, so back to the book and back to the kind of meat of the book. So you, what is more important to you? Is it more, because you do a bunch of really interesting things in the book? Is it to kind of reassure people? I mean, you talked about that reassurance being kind of your entry into this book, and that kind of pervades the book, to kind of make people who are going through normal things understand that this is actually the way our brains are built, and this is what we're supposed to be experiencing, and that in itself is huge medicine. But then you get into helping people actually understand the differences, the workings of memory, and I wonder kind of how you thought about as you were writing the book, like how much do I, because at a certain point people want to know stuff, but they don't really want to learn the science, you know, quasi-science of stuff. They want to understand like kind of the basics of it. So how do you kind of navigate that?
Yeah, so I very intentionally did not want this to feel like an academic textbook. I did not want it to be too long of a book. I wanted to keep the chapters short. I wanted each chapter to feel like something people could take away with and then tell their friends that it was easy enough and understandable enough that they could then tell their friends, oh, I learned this really cool thing about how memory works, or I understand now what happens when I have a word on the tip of my tongue. So I think it was each chapter I was hoping to give people a little of like, let's look under the hood. Like, here's what happened. Right. This is how memory works. And I didn't, you know, I hope it's not dumbed down so much, but it's, you know, I'm not writing a neurobiological textbook at all. So this is, here's how memory works. Here's what happens when it's not working and why. So, and then here's, you know, there's some tips in there for, you know, what helps your memory. So what improves it, you know, things like getting enough sleep and managing stress, and what can impair it, the difference between Alzheimer's and normal forgetting. But yeah, I think mostly I wanted folks to really recognize that, you know, there's not a supplement in this world. Everybody wants the supplement, right? Everybody wants the rabbit out of the hat or the magic pill. Everybody wants the pill for like, how do I stop having a word stuck on the tip of my tongue? Or what can I do so that I always remember where I parked my car? And there isn't a supplement out there for this. Our brains are designed in such a way that we're going to forget certain kinds of things regularly forever. And right. I find that reassuring and not frustrating or scary. I find that, and that's my hope. So that is one of the biggest hopes. And then I think, you know, there's an appendix at the back, which is, you know, sort of the quick hit list of like what to do to improve your memory day to day, because people like that. But there's also this idea again that it's this memory paradox. Like, memory is a really big deal. It's essential for the functioning of almost everything we do and right. Our identity, right? Our ability to remember, you know, who I've been and who I am. But it's also not such a big deal because it forgets most everything eventually. Like, we don't remember last week or last month very well. We only remember a handful of things from the past year really, really well. And that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a Zen thing in there, which is, if you can get there, which I don't feel like I'm, you know, there all the time, but I have experienced it before, and that is this kind of sensation of, well, I can't remember. That is really frustrating. I would love to remember, you know, the exact thing, particularly as a, you know, professional writer, you want to remember the details, you want to be able to report it, you know, accurately. But at the same time, you have this kind of sense of, but I know like the essence the essence of what I'm saying, the kind of larger point is there. And the larger point is there, not that I'm going to fudge the details. I'll like figure out a way to get the details if I don't have them, you know, in my brain right now. But if you had to choose between kind of having the larger truth, like the best, the most collaborative perspective, the most kind of overarching perspective on something that happened, and having some sort of like, you know, tunnel vision memory of the actual things that you saw and heard at that moment in time, you would definitely choose the larger picture. I mean, 100 times out of 100, because that's what's so great about being human is kind of having that big field of vision.
Yes. So our brains are great at remembering the gist of right. what happened, or the gist of, you know, a body of knowledge. Like you read, you know, a research paper and you get the gist of it. And what's kind of beautiful about living today is that, you know, life's an open book test. You can look up the details, you can right. Google it. And so this isn't, you know, making us dumber in any way, our ability to, you know, Google the name or Google the statistic. We weren't holding all of that information in our heads before the internet. This is now a way to expand what we have access to and what we can know and use. And it, our brains, yeah, we get the gist of what's going on. I should say there are about 100 or so people who've been diagnosed on this planet who have highly superior autobiographical memory. These folks remember in great detail every day of their lives from like the age of 10 or so. So they do remember last week's morning shower and what they had for lunch and all the text messages. And for some folks, this is a superpower. So Mary Lou Henner, the actress, has this. Mm. And I chatted with her several times and she's in the book. And I tried to stump her and I couldn't. So she, you know, I'll pick a date, like, you know, August 4th, 1986. And she's like, oh, that was a Saturday. And I went, you know, to visit Johnny Travolta. And we did, like, she has the whole day.
Oh, my God.
And then she wow. can tell you what was happening in the news and what she wore and what the weather was. And I threw in a day that I actually met her in New York City. And she's like, that's when you came to New York to see me. So she's got it all.
Oh, my God.
And she loves this. There are folks who have this where it's not the superpower you and I imagine it would be. It's they can't stop reliving the worst days of their lives in full technicolor detail, and they perseverate there. And so it's, you know, lends to sort of paralyzing depression. And then there's the folks, you know, there's a famous man, a case study in neuroscience. His name was S. He was studied by Alexander Luria, and he remembered everything and could memorize, you know, massive quantities of texts in a foreign language and mathematical formulas he didn't understand, and could regurgitate these in perfect detail years later. But he was somewhat impaired in day-to-day life too, because again, there was no background and foreground, right? Everything was remembered. So what was meaningful was just as remembered as what was inconsequential. And so he was really burdened by this.
Yeah, yeah, so I wrote about essence as well.
I think remembering the gist is really useful for our ability to function.
Right. Let me press you on something you said, because I wanna see if you'll stick to it. Is it really true that not having to remember all the phone numbers that we used to have to remember, like, you know, we used to have to remember dozens of phone numbers just to stay in touch with people? I mean, we'd have little books, but still, and now we don't. We don't remember a single, I can remember maybe one or two phone numbers that are old phone numbers, like, you know, that I grew up with. And I don't, so is that really okay? Or are we kind of getting lazy about some types of memory, and is that a little bit worse? Would it be better if we actually did exercise that part of our memory a little bit more?
I love this question. And you and I are old enough that, you know, I still remember all my childhood friends' phone numbers, and yet I literally don't know my two youngest kids' phone numbers. Like, I don't know what they are. And that just seems like bad parenting right there.
Yes, it does. And same thing, I'm talking about myself, but yes, it does.
But here's the question I'd ask of you, because a lot of people immediately assume this. Well, this is just bad. This is bad for me. Like, I should be memorizing these things. I used to memorize all kinds of things like phone numbers.
Right.
What does it better for what? How right. Are you going to improve your ability to remember other things if you memorize a dozen phone numbers? No. Are you going to improve your ability to remember, you know, details of the documentary film you watched or the book you read? Or are you going to be better able to find your phone when it goes missing if I memorize a dozen phone numbers? It doesn't translate. So yeah, we can, our brain, again, you can memorize 100,000 digits of pi if you decided you wanted to. So I can sit down and I can, you know, through repetition and maybe some associations, I can remember, you know, my children's phone numbers and, you know, a dozen others with no problem. It doesn't improve my memory ability for memorizing other things whatsoever. And it doesn't really improve my life because I don't need to memorize that. I have it. So our phones, our smartphones are sort of, you know, an externalization of our memory. It's an augmentation of our memory. And we can job share the job of memory with our phones in all kinds of really cool ways that don't have to be fearful for us, you know? So I wear glasses because my eyes need help seeing. We don't think twice about that. I can use Google or my contacts list to remember things for me to help aid in remembering. And it doesn't impair my memory's ability to do other things. So it's not like, oh, I haven't memorized phone numbers and now I'm just, you know, sitting on the couch staring at the wall, drooling. Like I'm busy doing, I think as a world, we're busier and using our brains more than ever. I mean, we don't have enough downtime probably, right?
Right, right.
When I was a kid, when we drove in the car, we stared out the window.
Right.
we looked at the world. We went right. for walks and just looked at the world. Now right. it's like, well, I should listen to a podcast while I walk. I should
right,
learn
right, right.
And remember some of that podcast so I can tell you about it. So we're yeah. using our memories a lot. Memorizing phone numbers doesn't, it's not cross training. It's not going to help you in other ways.
Yeah. And I will say, I think hearing you kind of say it that way, I think I not only agree with you, but I would take it a step further. This is just anecdotal, and it's just, again, it's just very, just me looking at myself, which is what I do so well. But I would say that for my own life, you know, being now in my mid-50s, we can say that, I would say that I think that my life has improved over and that my skills have improved over the last, say, 25 years or so, in that I am wiser because partly I just don't pay as much attention to every little detail. And I think more about the big picture, even in events where I probably should be remembering details. I actually have trained myself to pay attention to more of the kind of big picture, and I think that's made me a more interesting person, who maybe can contribute, you know, like on the idea level, a little bit better. And I don't want to paint it as a zero-sum game, but I think that I don't know. That's a little hunch I have about myself.
No, I think you're onto something. So there's the, you know, there's the memory for the stuff we know. So that's your semantic memory. It's the accumulation of knowledge, and that doesn't, you know, that doesn't diminish with age. You know, most people tend to think of, like, as we age, your memory gets worse. Processing speeds slow down. So you start to be like, sometimes you feel like you can see the wheels turning. Like, come on, you can get there, find right. the word, do the thing. So that happens, but we don't have an impairment in what we've learned. Like, the stuff you know stays with you. And so you have this accumulated body of wisdom as you get older, which is better than ever. You know, you right. know more now than you did when you were 25. And a lot of us, as we get older, we like you're saying, like, you have the memory for the gist. You have the memory for concepts and patterns. We get to sort of see, we've lived enough to be able to have experienced and notice, oh, there's a similar pattern between this and that, or this concept feels like this concept, or I can now make conclusions based on this body of knowledge that I wouldn't have, you know, understood or noticed when I was younger. So our memories for the stuff we know accumulate over time, and we, as we age, are more attuned to patterns and concepts than we were when we were younger. Yeah. So you marry them together, and this is why they say, you know, wisdom comes with age. It's in part because of that.
Right. At least that's what I keep telling myself. Wisdom comes with age. Let's get a little dark now, because I'm sure, you know, this book is going to sell, I don't know, let's say 2 million copies. So just statistically, is that a little low? Should I have said 10 million? 10 million. Let's say 10 million copies. Yeah. Let's say 100 million. Sure. This book is going to sell 100 million copies. So just statistically, those 100 million people, and that some of them will pass it to another person. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of people will see the book, and then those people know, let's say, 2 billion people. So basically the whole world will come into contact with this book, as they should. And I'm getting to my point. Some of those people statistically will either personally be at the beginning of Alzheimer's disease or know someone, be observing someone. And they'll, and same with this interview. It'll be seen by, you know, probably a billion people. So let's talk to those people. What is a disturbing thing to notice that isn't a normal functioning? You know, what are the things that we look out for where it's like, you know, if that's happening, you should probably go see a neurologist. You should probably get a couple of basic tests made.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? One of the things I'm out there pounding the pavement about is sort of normalizing brain health and getting people comfortable with talking about brain health. So, you know, we're perfectly happy to go to our primary care physician and check our heart health, right? We'll get our blood pressure taken, we'll get blood drawn for cholesterol, we'll be talking about getting a certain number of steps in a day. Anything from the neck up, we seem to think we have no influence over. And so, yeah, I think that one of the things I'd love to see people get more comfortable with is being in conversation with their doctor about, like, hey, here are the kinds of things I'm forgetting, and like, this is what my cognitive health feels like today.
Right.
Okay. And then next appointment, we can compare this year versus last year. So what are the kinds of things that could be potentially concerning? So I talk about tip of the tongue in the book. There's a whole chapter on it because this plagues all of us, right? Like, oh, what's his name? What's the name of that movie my friend recommended on Netflix? Tip of the tongue is really common for all of us, whether you're 20 or 60. It tends to be pronouns. So just neurobiologically speaking, pronouns are like in little neurological cul-de-sacs and really hard to get to ultimately, as opposed to just a common word, which is kind of like tons of intersections in the middle of Main Street downtown, easy to come by. So if you're having lots of tip of the tongues for names of cities, book titles, movie titles, actors, a person's name, don't sweat it. But if you're starting to go like, oh, what's the thing, the name of the thing I write with, you know, the thing I write words on the paper with, a pen? Yes. Like if words that are common go missing a lot for you, and like this happens to our friend Greg O'Brien all day long, you know, he can't remember the name of the stuff that we use. You know, what's the name, the thing I drink water from, what's that called? The glass?
Right.
Yeah. So if that's happening, you bring that to your doctor. That's concerning. If you lose your keys and your phone, like that's probably an attention problem, a distraction problem, not a memory problem. But if you find your keys or your phone and you think, like, what do I do with this? What is this for? Why do I need this? Or if you look at your phone and you suddenly are like, I don't know how to work this. If you have that glitch moment where that's more concerning. That's different than just misplacing it due to attention, most likely. People talk about like, oh, I can't remember where I parked my car. That's normal. And again, likely an attention issue. If it's something more concerning, like our friend Greg O'Brien will not recognize his car. He'll be standing in front of it and it won't compute to his brain that belongs to him, or he won't remember how he got there. This happens to folks with Alzheimer's. I've heard this over and over again. They walk out into a parking lot and think, I don't remember how I got here. So that's, you know, the first thing to go in Alzheimer's, the first thing under attack in your brain is the hippocampus.
Right.
Which I mentioned is this part of your brain that's necessary for the formation of new consciously held memories. So if this part of the brain is under attack, you can imagine that that information that's recently happened won't go into a lasting memory. So I can't remember having driven to the store because that happened a few minutes ago and I really am a little fuzzy on like, how did I get here? Or I'll repeat, so if you start repeating yourself a lot because you don't remember that you told someone something.
Right.
Someone's
right.
saying, you're repeating yourself a lot and you don't remember, you're not aware of this. Like, I don't remember telling you this. Again, this is a conversation to bring to your primary care physician. And treat it like heart health, people. It doesn't mean like, oh, if I admit I've got a memory problem, I'm gonna fall off the cliff into end stage Alzheimer's tomorrow. It's like, again, like heart disease, we have ways we can prevent. We have ways that we can prolong the distance and push Alzheimer's way off into the distance by doing the right things, right, for your brain health. So we know that heart-healthy Mediterranean diet can reduce your risk of Alzheimer's and dementia by half. It's a lot, right? If we had a pharmaceutical, if I had a pill for you and said, here, this is gonna reduce your risk of Alzheimer's by half, you would take it.
Right.
So we know sleeping 7 to 9 hours a night is hugely important. And I've got a whole chapter in my book as to why. Because I think, again, part of the book is like, I can tell you it's super important for you to get sleep every night. This is going to help you. It's going to help you lock in the memories of stuff you created today. It's going to help you learn new stuff tomorrow. And it's going to prevent Alzheimer's. Like, okay. But I kind of can let that, I don't know, I can kind of space out on that unless you tell me why. Like, so in the book, I said, this is what your brain's doing while you sleep.
Right.
That helps. So you know that every time you can give yourself 7 to 9 hours of sleep, it's like, I just prevented Alzheimer's a little bit. Like every night.
Absolutely.
Like, don't worry about the years you haven't slept. Because that's already water under the bridge. If you don't have Alzheimer's today, that means that like you're still okay, right? You haven't, you know, all of that's already done. Like, what are you going to do now? So,
Yeah. And I will say there was a period of my life a long time ago where I thought sleep was for suckers. And I just thought I had, you know, I like felt guilty about getting too much sleep, which is so silly. Yeah, I'm glad that
a lot of people still feel that way. I just posted something recently to social media about the importance of sleep. It was World Sleep Day. And a lot of comments were people saying like, I get 9 hours of sleep a night and I feel so guilty about that.
Right.
And there, we as a culture, we are like that. We're like, are you getting enough done? Like, are you lazy? Are you, you know, if you're sleeping, you're lazy. And it's like, like,
well, let's spend the last, we only have like 2 or 3 minutes, but let's spend one or two of them talking a little bit. People need to understand sleep is not like wasted time. We are designed. We owe every living thing, every animal needs sleep. Why? Well, a big part of the reason is that our brains are consolidating these memories, right? We need that time to keep our brain in functioning order from day to day.
Yeah, I mean, so this clicked for me, and this is a lot of Matthew Walker's work. It's why would all living things
right.
have evolved to devote so much time to sleeping, right? Like, we've spent years of our lives asleep at this point at our age, right?
Right.
At like 16 cumulative years of sleep. So it's right. like, it's not a state of doing nothing. That's the thing. Like, we're not conscious for it, but our body is super busy doing things that are essential to the health and functioning of every organ system in our body, including our brains. So we need it to consolidate memories. We need it to clear away the metabolic debris that accumulated during the business of being awake so that we don't get Alzheimer's. It's vital to your mental health, cardiovascular health, not getting cancer. So it's, I think it really helps for folks to understand like, oh, my brain and body are busy cleaning up and doing business while I sleep, necessary business while I sleep. So it's not a state of unconscious nothingness.
Right, absolutely. Get more sleep and don't feel guilty about it. Feel decadent about it. Feel like you've just done something great for yourself and just do that every day. And like you said, don't worry about the sleep you've missed in the past. We've all done stuff that is stupid, but we can be smarter and wiser as we go on.
Yeah, no more, we do better. Yep.
Lisa, this has been such a privilege to talk to you for an hour straight. We made it almost an hour without mentioning Rudy Tanzi. I'm just throwing his name out there because I've never not talked to you for anything like this and not talked about Rudy. So
hilarious.
And I hope this book sells those 100 million copies that it deserves to sell. And I can't wait to see what your next one is on. And we'll hopefully talk about that one too.
Thank you so much. Can't wait to see you in real life someday soon.
Yeah, for sure. Someday soon. Yeah. All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. Subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Send us an email to podcasts@c-span.org.